From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. French obstructionism on the American war march to Baghdad has had predictable reactions in the U.S. press. The term cheese-eating surrender monkeys has been invoked, for instance. And with the future of the NATO alliance perhaps hanging in the balance, says Martin Walker of United Press International, some European editorialists have also succumbed to French bashing.
I was particularly struck by a long column in the Daily Telegraph this week by Boris Johnson, who's a British Member of Parliament and also editor of the weekly The Spectator. The way he puts it is, if I were Tony Blair, I'd be feeling really rather grateful to the French this week, because the British press has dropped its concerns in favour of that time-honoured staple of the British journalist, the orgy of frog bashing. You know the kind of articles. They involve references to Vichy, tanks with reverse gears, garlic-guzzling peasants, women of loose morals cozying up to German occupiers, and they usually end with the cry, "And those Frenchmen eat our children's ponies." That is pretty much the blizzard of abuse that the French have been getting in the British press. And the French have been really, I think, really quite mature about it. Libération, the left-wing French daily, said, what we are witnessing now is simply the old American cocktail of missionary zeal and crude realpolitik. We've been there before and we'll be there again.
I want to turn to the Arab world for a moment. Much of the editorial commotion in the last 2 weeks has been in the wake of Secretary Powell's dramatic presentation to the United Nations, in which he attempted to demonstrate that Saddam Hussein is flouting the UN resolution on disarmament. And the attention in the press in the West has been, well, did the Secretary make his case? But not so in the Arab press.
Absolutely not. The Arab press has been focusing upon another speech of Colin Powell's altogether, and that was the one which he delivered to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when he said that the invasion of Iraq is aimed, I quote, at reshaping the Middle East region in a positive way that will enhance American interests. Now, the Arab press has gone absolutely crazy over this. They see it as a return to that moment in 1918 when the British and French carved up the Middle East between them with the fall of the Ottoman Empire. In Beirut's As-Safir, an editorial by the publisher Talal Salman, who's a very, very respected figure, cites the speech by Colin Powell. The tragedy is our leaders are now reduced to appeasing Washington at any cost. Therefore, they deferred any discussion of Iraq until they had reassured themselves that they had regained Washington's approval. It is extraordinary that no Arab leader has even considered visiting Baghdad to mediate in the crisis. They are becoming servile to Washington to an extraordinary degree.
Do you get any sense from reading these editorials that they are reacting to the threat of American imperialism per se, or maybe the fundamentalist threat should the democracy at the ballot box overturn existing regimes and open the Pandora's box of Islamism?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think certainly there is genuine alarm throughout the more liberal Arab press of the implications of democracy and the extraordinary popularity of people like Osama bin Laden in much of the Arab world. But there's also this traditional Arab rejection of being told what to do by the outsiders from the West.
One last thing, Martin. I want to ask you about the Osama bin Laden tape. Some in the West, in the Western press, have interpreted his remarks as the final evidence that there is some sort of connection between al-Qaeda and the Saddam Hussein regime. In Europe, I gather they've drawn different conclusions?
Well, they have, except for one or two conservative newspapers like the Daily Telegraph in Britain, which does see it as pretty conclusive. In Russia, the Nezavisimaya Gazeta thought it was a bit of a conspiracy theory. After a three-month silence, terrorist number one has once again spoken to the world. Observers note a number of curious coincidences. This unfortunate cassette appeared at the height of the transatlantic arguments over Iraq. Colin Powell appeared to have it even before Al Jazeera. In Austria's Der Standard, nobody in Europe, not even the closest ally, Britain, is following America's reasoning that Iraq is planning to arm al-Qaeda with weapons of mass destruction. It's frivolous to exploit this fear and thus to define the Iraq crisis in populist fashion as a showdown between the Western and Islamic cultures.
Well, Martin, once again, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is the chief correspondent for United Press International.
This week, the Pentagon announced when and where hundreds of reporters would be embedded, their term, with troops in the battlefield if there's war in Iraq. It was about this time last year, as the U.S. waged war in Afghanistan, that we learned Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl had been murdered in Pakistan. For veteran war correspondent Scott Anderson, Pearl's death marked a terrible shift for people in his line of work. There was a time, he observed recently in the New York Times magazine, when war reporters were mostly spared the carnage because both sides wanted their stories told. But in the last 15 years, as warring factions began to prey more and more on civilians, it no longer served them to have massacres reported to the outside world.
When you're slaughtering civilians, you don't want the outside world to report on that. So you as a journalist coming into an area like that are in much greater risk.
Give me a contrast from your own experience from a time before the shift and a time after.
I was in El Salvador in the early 1980s. El Salvador, of course, was a horrific war. But journalists who were stationed there were able to cross between battle lines rather freely just by, in black tape, marking on their cars TV or Prensa, press.
They would shoot around the cars.
At times they would shoot around the cars. There were cases of film crews on a battlefield just with a TV camera waving a white flag, and they were able to sort of wander across the battlefield. 8 years later, in the Bosnia War, journalists started doing the same thing of taping their cars with saying TV or press. And what they discovered in Bosnia was that the Serbs were deliberately targeting those cars. So what the journalists had done was to put bullseyes on themselves. So where in Salvador in 1982, 84, certainly the guerrillas there saw the outside media as their way to tell the rest of the world of what they were fighting for. What you saw in Bosnia in 1992 was, the last thing we want is for journalists to be in these areas and see what we're doing.
So they didn't want journalists to tell their stories. But is there something about the way journalism has been practiced in the last 15 years that's contributed to that?
Well, for one thing, the world has gotten very much smaller. There's no such thing anymore as domestic media or domestic coverage. With the internet, with satellite TV, the whole world knows what's happening everywhere, and they know how it's being reported.
So if they see a banner on CNN that says, America Strikes Back, they naturally, I guess, identify the reporters sitting in front of that banner with that position.
That's right. And the main area I cover is the Middle East. And 15 years ago, even people who were, quote, anti-American, there might be the insinuation that they thought I was part of the Zionist conspiracy or, you know, an agent of the American government. What's happened now is that that's sort of a starting point given in their minds. That's an assumption on their part. And I think with Danny Pearl's murder, I think why it was such a haunting and watershed event was you've seen this evolution from journalists being seen as neutral to them being targeted when they came across their path, like in places like Bosnia. And what you had with Danny Pearl for the first time was a journalist being deliberately set up, like hunting down journalists.
You wrote in the New York Times piece that the Wall Street Journal had announced that it wasn't going to be sending any of its reporters to Baghdad if there were a war in Iraq. What happens to war coverage if major news outlets decide to pull out of covering the conflicts?
Well, what happens is what has already happened in places like Algeria and Chechnya. Algeria has been the site of one of the bloodiest wars of the past 20, 30 years. Over 100,000 people have been killed in Algeria. No one knows about it because over 60 journalists have been killed in Algeria, mostly local journalists. Both sides have taken turns murdering journalists to ensure that the story doesn't get told. Chechnya, tiny little country, I think 16, 17 journalists have been killed in an area the size of Connecticut, mostly by Russian soldiers. So what that does is it ensures that Chechnya is sort of off the radar. So the Russians can then characterize the conflict there however they want to. And, you know, I think if you think back on Desert Storm, there was so little reporting from Baghdad, and a lot of things that happened during that war, because there weren't journalists there to report it, are kind of lost in the ether. You know, one thing that really struck me was Timothy McVeigh. He was in this unit where they went in with armored shovels right after the bombing. And one of his job was to go into the berms where the Iraqi troops were and basically bury them alive. This was an official part of the, you know, the first wave of the American army going into Kuwait. I'd never heard that until...
Never heard that story.
Yeah, but it was a policy. Apparently it had been reported somewhere in kind of a small, obscure place, but because you didn't have journalists up at the front, it's like, wow, you know, we have an official policy of, like, burying people alive. Remarkable.
Well, obviously, if we have a war in Iraq, it certainly won't be off the radar. During the last Gulf War, we all know they corralled journalists into little rooms and fed them videotapes, and those went out to the public, and that's how we knew that war. Now, in what appears to be a concession, the Pentagon is allowing reporters to embed, that's the expression, with troops in the field. They've received some training, so they won't become a liability to the war effort. And I suppose the idea is to allow reporters a freer access to the war zone and allow them to report more freely.
Freer access on one side of the story. And I think that what the Pentagon would like is that the whole coverage, if we go to war in Iraq, consists of journalists talking to soldiers in the field who, like, miss their wives and miss their kids, but, you know, we're here to do our patriotic duty and not hear anything about what's happening on the other side.
So over time, a different strategy developed for dealing with the press, or a variety of strategies?
What has developed is media handling strategies, from the very crude in places like Sierra Leone and Liberia, which is where you kill them, to the much more sophisticated of what the American military does, which is to co-opt them. You need to control the media one way or the other.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Scott Anderson has covered conflicts for the New York Times Magazine and is author of The Man Who Tried to Save the World, about an American relief worker who disappeared in Chechnya.
Coming up, an Arab news channel with a Scottish accent, also a state house that took license with license plates.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Ron Ziegler died this week of a heart attack at his home outside San Diego at the age of 63. He'll go down in history, most likely, as the worst regarded spokesman of the late 20th century. At the tender age of 29, he was already a longtime supporter of Richard Nixon when he took on the job as his White House press secretary. And for the press, he was the de facto face of Watergate. Ziegler's appearances in the press room were marked by stonewalling and what appeared to be stone-cold lying. But his most famous remark is the one he never made. He never actually said that one of his earlier statements was inoperative, a now notorious euphemism for lying. In presenting a reversal by the administration, he said, "That is the operative statement." And when a waggish reporter asked if his earlier assertion was inoperative, he said yes. Though Ziegler always claimed he was in the loop, as time wore on, he wore down. The stone wall developed cracks. If my answers sound confusing, he said near the end, I think it's because they are confusing, because the questions are confusing and the situation is confusing, and I'm not in a position to clarify it. He later claimed that he never knowingly lied to the press, and that's not hard to believe. In recent times, Ziegler has been cited as a possible candidate for Deep Throat, the source that Woodward and Bernstein so famously relied upon. But that is simply impossible, say the people who knew him best. Ron Ziegler served his president like a soldier, like a bodyguard, and he sacrificed his reputation like a bodyguard lays down his life. Abiding loyalty was, in fact, Ron Ziegler's greatest strength. But, as history has often shown, loyalty in a bad cause is an even greater weakness.
Back in 1865, in the heyday of the Ottoman Empire, Arab journalists were required by law to, quote, report on the precious health of the Sultan. A century and a half later, reporting in the region has only now begun to change. A rush of competition has seen the launch of many new satellite channels, and an acknowledgement that the more unfettered the reporting, the bigger the audience. The newest channel, which went on the air this weekend, is the English-language Arab TV, or ATV, completely unknown until last week. ATV scooped the world media when it taped a rare interview with Saddam Hussein. At the time, though, it had no TV channel to broadcast it on. Ron Mackay is the mastermind behind ATV, and he joins us now from London. Ron, welcome to On the Media.
Well, thank you very much.
So you're a brand new news organization, and you have the scoop certainly of the year, if not the decade, and you have no TV network to run it on. What an odd situation to be in.
Well, we had, as you do have in these situations, technical problems, and so, yes, we had one of the scoops of the decade and nowhere to play it out. So, basically, we had to make the best deals we could with the international broadcasters. But we're hopeful that we'll get many more such scoops.
Last week on our show, we spoke about the glut of new satellite channels launching in the Mideast. The provenance of the funding of many of these channels is Arab business people who are in various ways connected with various Arab governments. To what extent are the people who are bankrolling you beholden to governments somewhere in the Arab world?
We are not the broadcaster here. We are, the content provider. So we have a contract to provide that content. And the number one clause is that we have entire editorial independence. And the funding has no governmental or regime connections, whatever. It's largely financed by a Jordanian businessman, somebody I've known for several years. And so I know it's uncontaminated money, and certainly the editorial output will be uncontaminated, although ultimately the sanction is the checkbook, isn't it?
I saw a piece in The Guardian by one of your producers in which he made many broad accusations about the Western media and struck quite a derisive tone toward the Bush administration, mm-hmm. and a not especially nuanced one. Is Arab TV anti-West TV?
Not at all. I think probably what he was trying to demonstrate to people outside is the arrogance sometimes, from American journalists, from British journalists, jetting into war zones for a week or two and then, jetting off to the next war zone. But no, there's no agenda against the Western media. I mean, the Western media serves the West. I think we're doing something different to that.
Now, this week we were treated to another taped message, at least purporting to be from Osama bin Laden. Al Jazeera ran it. You had tape in your hands 2 days before Al Jazeera. This is different material than what we saw on Wednesday?
Yeah, different material, and much longer. It runs for some 50-odd minutes and contains some pretty blood-curdling threats. We decided not to run it at the time because of the ethical considerations involved. The person who had the tape wanted quite a lot of money for it, and we decided that we shouldn't pay that.
That seems like an ethical question to get started on as a network, checkbook journalism. When a news organization is buying a tape from a source at least connected with worldwide terrorism, do you fear that you are put in the position of actually sponsoring and funding worldwide terrorism?
Well, that was one of the elements of the decision when we decided that we weren't going to pay any money for it. We didn't want to be accused of spin doctoring or being part of the process. Obviously, it was an incredibly difficult decision because every news organization in the world wants this. But we decided that we weren't going to pay for it, and that's the decision that we stuck to.
I notice you do have an accent. I'm trying to figure out which part of the Arab world that it's connected to.
It's a well-known Arab capital called Glasgow.
What's a Scotsman like you doing in a project like this?
Well, I've been reporting and visiting the Middle East and indeed war zones for 25 years, and my interest has always been in Arab politics, and it was an idea that time seemed to have come for. So here I am, and inshallah, it'll succeed.
That's Arabic for God willing.
That's right.
Well, all best of luck to you.
Thanks very much.
Ron Mackay is the founder of Arab TV, an English language satellite channel operating out of London and Baghdad.
Across America, the license plate is a great vehicle for self-expression. In fact, in a couple of minutes, you'll hear Bob describe the lengths to which people will go in his state of Virginia to vent on their bumpers. But not only do Virginians use the letter number combos on vanity plates to send a message, the state's Department of Motor Vehicles offers roughly 180 specialty plates, including some with university and club seals, a butterfly, eagle, horsehead, ducks, and George Washington. This month, the Virginia State House okayed yet another design for a specialty plate, the embossed words, Choose Life. Choose Life is the name of an organization that supports adoption. It claims to take no stand on abortion. Kent Willis is executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Virginia, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Now, it seems strange that the ACLU would object to any kind of speech, but you object to the way this design was selected, right?
We object to the fact that this is one side of the speech. This is a license plate saying Choose Life, where the proceeds from it go only to organizations that refuse to acknowledge that anyone should be able to receive an abortion.
Then would your concerns be addressed somewhat if the state also offered a plate that said, for instance, Choose Choice?
If the state were able to do both, it might satisfy a lot of the free speech concerns. But what we're talking about here in general is the state creating a forum for speech and then deciding by majority vote of the legislators who gets to speak and who doesn't. The state of Virginia has to allow equal access to these plates to anyone that wants to express their views.
There was another case in Virginia which pitted the Sons of Confederate Veterans against the state. In that case, the organization wanted the option of putting the Confederate flag on their plates, and the state was sued for censorship.
This is really the pivotal case because this is the case that went to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, a step just below the U.S. Supreme Court, where they were deciding for the first time just what these special license plates were. In that case, a bill was introduced for the Sons of Confederate Veterans. The original bill also had in it that the Sons of Confederate Veterans logo, the Confederate battle flag, would appear on the license plate along with their name. When the state finally passed the bill, they took off the Confederate battle flag because they decided it wasn't appropriate to be on a license plate. The Sons of Confederate Veterans sued, went to court, and that's when the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ultimately said, these license plates are a public forum, and you can't censor what takes place in a public forum, and so the Confederate battle flag stays.
I remember a few years back some New Hampshire residents opposed for religious reasons the state slogan, Live Free or Die, that appears on their plates.
Someone decided that they did not like that message on their plate, so they put some tape over it. That case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said in the same way you can't force someone to say the Pledge of Allegiance, you can't force them to state the state's slogan if they disagree with it.
Would you describe what the current state of play is on the Choose Life license plate?
The legal landscape regarding license plates now appears to be this. The U.S. Supreme Court in the New Hampshire case said that you cannot compel someone to put a certain point of view on their plate. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Sons of Confederate Veterans case said that you cannot censor something that's put on a license plate. And now, out of a federal district court in South Carolina, we have a judge saying that the state cannot endorse a certain point of view on the license plate.
That's the Choose Life case we're talking about right now.
Yes.
Eight states have already approved Choose Life license plates. Is this battle already lost for the ACLU?
No. In fact, no court has ruled in favor of one of these plates. And certainly, it is likely that if Virginia passes the law for a Choose Life plate, it will be challenged in court and most likely by the ACLU. We believe that for consistency's sake, at the very least, that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals would strike down the Choose Life case as unconstitutional. And it is indeed possible that that case would end up before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kent Willis is Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Virginia.
The other day, I was stuck in traffic in Northern Virginia, where I live, and in front of me was a car with the following license plate, B-U-T-T-H-D. Virginia is for lovers. Nobody ever said anything about self-esteem. For me, though, this was an epiphany. The Internet may well be a tool of mass expression, but it certainly isn't unprecedented.
L-O-A-N-W-U-F.
Long Wolf. I'm a senior loan officer for Bronner Mortgage here in Fairfax.
Fly kites. Fly kites you do?
Yes.
Why do you want everybody else to know?
I go to a lot of kite festivals.
We got caught up into it and thought, hey, why not? So I got Big Red and my husband got Big Mac.
Vanity plates. Long before there was an internet, there was an interstate net of license tag message boards as analog as can be.
H-A-R-T-A-A-U. Mm-hmm. Heart of gold, right?
Heart of gold.
What's it all about?
Well, I was actually inspired by the Hitchhiker's Guide series, Zaphod Beeblebrox and his starship Heart of Gold.
And this is something you think the rest of the world should know?
Oh, absolutely. I am Zaphod Beeblebrox.
And I am really scared right now.
Names, initials, job descriptions, hobbies, you literally name it. Virginia has 781,000 vanity plates active at the moment, representing more than 12% of vehicle registrations.
And that's about the highest in the country.
University of Richmond economics professor Eric Kraft says Virginia may or may not be more autobiographical than other states, but it's certainly cheaper. The nominal $10 added fee, he says, drives the business.
Oh, well, there's still millions of dollars involved, so I wouldn't call it trivial.
Anyway, the money isn't trivial. There's also the question of subject matter. Commissioner of Motor Vehicles, Rick Holcomb.
I love just riding down the road and looking at plates and trying to figure out something about that person. Maybe where did they go to school? When did they graduate? What's their profession? What sports team do they root for?
Yeah, and what kind of car they drive. A stunningly common vanity plate concept is to document the make of the vehicle bolted to the license tag. My Benz, my Jag, my BMW, my God, my Kia. And motorists will go to all sorts of tortured lengths, where the correct spellings have been snapped up, to phonetically approximate the sound, like KRVT for Corvette. Virginians can use the DMV website to experiment with letter combinations and order online. Jamie Haybecker of the department's Web Services Division shows off this message generator.
Once they've found one that is available, it'll tell them, congratulations, the message you've requested is available. Or it will tell them that it's not available and they can try another combination.
For instance, ugly is taken. I-M-E-Z is taken. Rufus, Doofus, and Goofus are all taken, although I'm pleased to report that yeast, felon, and gum disease are all wide open. Job references, of course, are very popular. Butcher and baker, for instance. Foot doc, eye doc, kid doc, and naturally DDS are long gone. The profession to have if you want to exploit unspoken for obviousness is
Accounting, audit, for example, is available. Your taxes is available. W-2 for you, inexplicably, is available.
Type into there for me, please. LIFO, L-I-F-O.
Last in, first out. Message is available.
What does it say to you about the state of creativity among Commonwealth of Virginia accountants that LIFO and FIFO are both available?
Maybe they're just not a terribly imaginative group.
Precisely. Like the World Wide Web it predated, the Vanity Plate universe, and not just the accounting part of it, is mainly a vast wasteland of the shockingly unimaginative, the unclever, and the excruciatingly banal. That is, except when the challenge is to be truly vile at 60 miles per hour. Here, creativity blooms. For example, the plate THSO seems innocuous until it is spied in your rearview mirror. Oh, my. Needless to say, as you work that one out in your mind's eye, the state takes a dim view of objectionable material. Vanity plate messages are speech. They are not necessarily protected speech. Commissioner Holcomb.
I do not believe the plate to be a First Amendment forum. It is state property. I guess I would look at a license plate much the same way as the U.S. Post Office will look at a stamp.
Right, and stamps are imprinted with flags and flowers and the Virgin Mary and Elvis, not the words lick me. So, lick me and poop on you and I'm a hoe and much, much, much worse are on a list of the 6,000-plus words you cannot say on your GT. And the list grows every day as state employees actually conjugate vulgarities to anticipate subsequent distasteful permutations. But look, there is licentious license behavior, and there is romance. Consider Professor Eric Kraft, the economist.
My first vanity plate from about 5 years ago is S-V-E-V.
That, as you know, is an erotic Scandinavian folk dance.
Since there aren't a whole lot of Scandinavians down here in Richmond, I thought I would sort of put something Swedish or Norwegian on my plate and see if anyone might come tap my window or stop by sometime when I was, or wave at me.
Are you trying to pick up women with Svev?
I'm trying to actually catch anyone's interest who has an interest in Swedish folk dance and culture.
And if that person were a Nordic goddess, so much the better.
Well, that would be fine.
Okay, the total today is $97.
Could you just read that back to me so I know I have it, the
plate number? It'll be W2 space with the logo in the middle for you.
All right, that's perfect. Thank you.
Coming up, why coping with the internet needs the patience of a saint and a late, unlamented movie genre.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Back in 1989, years before the internet infiltrated Iraq and Google got to China, President Ronald Reagan cheerfully predicted that, quote, the Goliath of totalitarianism will be brought down by the David of the microchip. Not necessarily, says a recent study by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Shanti Kalatal, co-author of the new book, Open Networks, Closed Regimes, The Impact of the Internet on Authoritarian Rule, says that authoritarian regimes use a variety of technical and legal tools, from firewalls in China to computer bans in Burma, to control public access to information in the Internet age. And it's not just governments that are quick to restrict access, she says. In some nations, citizens are helping shut the door. Shanti, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Now, there were two very interesting findings in Singapore and Saudi Arabia. In Singapore, where there's a kind of social compact where the populace accepts a certain amount of authoritarian government in exchange for a very stable way of life. And in Saudi Arabia, where conservative social values have actually caused individual citizens to actually volunteer to the government information on sites that have dangerous or subversive material. To what extent does the public actually participate in its own political repression?
Well, that's a really interesting point. I mean, I think that there's often an assumption that if only the public can get access to the Internet and to these liberating technologies of information, they'll automatically demand political reform from the government. And what you see, particularly in the case of Singapore, is that that's not necessarily true. You know, in this case, the government's really pushed the Internet on everybody. They've not only allowed access, but they've really used it to modernize their bureaucracy, to create a lot of government citizen services that improve the quality of life for their citizens. And in that case, what you do see is a lot of popular support for the government that's managed to use technology to their benefit and to the population's benefit. In Saudi Arabia, it's the public that's spearheading some of this censorship effort. They're the ones that don't necessarily want a lot of what might be perceived as immoral Western images penetrating the country. One of the government censors has said that for every 100 unblock requests that they get in, they get something like 500 block requests to the government censorship site.
One of the more disturbing observations in your report is that Western companies, including American ones, are selling the software in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere that permits the government to filter and otherwise censor information on the Internet. How do they justify this kind of behavior? Isn't it kind of like selling illegal weaponry to Iraq?
In the private sector, I think the general feeling is that some of these governments are just their customers and they don't inquire what they do with the technology once it's been sold. You know, a company that sells blocking technology, for instance, can argue that it can be used by schools to block out pornography. But I think that it is a bit of a disconnect because many of these companies do go out there and sort of paint themselves as these proponents of free speech abroad, but when they're actually operating abroad, they don't necessarily live up to that.
Well, the conclusion of your study is that Ronald Reagan may have been speaking too soon in mouthing the conventional wisdom that the Internet was going to eventually be the salvation of all free peoples everywhere. But in the end, isn't the history of political action in totalitarian societies that freedom-seeking people eventually harness the tools available to them, no matter how much the government is snooping on them, no matter what laws are imposed? I'm thinking of the Berlin Wall. I mean, there were soldiers in turrets with rifles shooting at people trying to get out, but they couldn't keep information from coming in, and it was the information, as much as anything else, that eventually sent the wall tumbling down.
Yeah, I think that information can be very powerful. In the case of a crisis, for instance, it is possible that the Internet may be able to focus public opinion in a certain way and really exacerbate a political crisis. And we've actually seen this happen already with certain domestic incidents in China where a very small local incident happens, the government tries to cover it up. And because people get on the Internet and circulate their version of events, eventually it becomes a national scandal and the government has to respond. But to say that, you know, it's inevitable that people will rise up and use these tools, I don't necessarily think that it's inevitable.
Well, Shanti Kalatal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shanti Kalatal is an associate in the Information Revolution and World Politics Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She and Taylor C. Boas are the co-authors of the book Open Networks, Closed Regimes, The Impact of the Internet on Authoritarian Rule.
Whether the door to democracy or merely the purveyor of crass materialism, pornography, and spam, the Internet certainly is a mysterious place, and many of us have invoked God, in one way or the other, to help guide our way through it. Now the Catholic Church is pondering the idea of a patron saint of the Internet, and joining us now to discuss this is Monsignor James P. Moroney, an expert on prayer for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here today.
Good. Now, so far, our Vatican sources tell us that the Pope is keeping mum, but thousands of Catholics are casting their votes for likely candidates, naturally, via the Internet. Are you pleased with this response?
You obviously have very highly placed Vatican sources who are giving you the information. And indeed, I think I'm always pleased, as every Christian is pleased, whenever we seek the intercession of the saints. That's really what we're talking about when we talk about patron saints. We're talking about people who are our friends in the kingdom of heaven who can pray for us and who can guide us by their example. So the Internet is certainly in need of prayers as much as any means of communication has been throughout the ages.
So if you were a betting man, and I'll assume you're not, which saint would you put your money on?
Well, I don't know whether I would put my money on a particular saint, but I think the Internet has pretty well voted. One of the finalists, if you will, in this Northern Italian poll from the website that first gave discussion to this a few weeks ago, is St. Isidore of Seville. And in fact, for many, many years, there's been interest in St. Isidore as a model for those who surf the Internet. And I'd say the major reason is because he was an extraordinary influence back in the 6th century, which you'll recall is right in the midst of the Dark Ages in Europe, a time when learning was very, very threatened. And yet he, in this very transitional time, moving, if you will, from the ancient world into the first part of the Middle Ages, he was one of the foremost visionaries when it came to education and to spreading information. He issued one of the first encyclopedias. They call it the Etymologia, 20 volumes of everything that everybody knew about everything in those days. Today, the Internet tries to do the same thing, but it takes a little more than 20 volumes, I think.
Now, Monsignor, I don't want to differ with you on fine points of theology here, but...
God forbid.
I don't think that's the reason why St. Isidore is the leading candidate. Do you want to know my theory?
What's your theory?
Okay, well, I've been reading up on him, and I read that the man in charge of Isidore's education was his brother, who was a kind of spare-the-rod-spoil-the-child sort of teacher. Isidore ran away. He was frustrated with his own rate of learning, not to mention the abuse he was taking. And somewhere along the way, he acquired a degree of patience that was truly worthy of a saint.
Well, I think any one of us who have been threatened to throw the computer out of the window when we can't quite get to the site that we're looking for would quite agree that patience is important.
My point exactly. When do you think the Pope will rule on this issue and how?
I think the Holy Father will listen to what people have to say, but realize it's not so much of a horse race in which only one person wins. Indeed, there can be many patrons of the Internet, just as there are many patrons of various churches or various guilds or various occupations. So I would suggest that everybody picks their own patron. As long as they pray to them and they look to them for good example, that the Internet might be a means for us to disseminate truth and to act in charity.
Monsignor, is there a prayer for the Internet?
There are many prayers for the Internet, but perhaps as you suggested before, any prayer for patience is probably adequate for the Internet.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. God bless you.
Monsignor James P. Moroney is an expert on prayer for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Fringe filmmakers have known since the 1920s that sleaze can sell tickets as well as any big-name star or slick script. Generally low-budget and low-brow, thousands of exploitation films turn to profit on the promise of cheap thrills. Disdained by critics and virtually extinct by the 90s, features like Nude on the Moon and Alice in Acid Land are enjoying renewed interest. OTM's Rex Doan dons his 3D glasses for a closer look at a sordid cinematic tradition.
42nd Street, Times Square.
Back when 42nd Street was known as the Deuce, subway passengers emerging from the Times Square station would be assaulted by movie theater marquees that blared out titles like Gutter Trash, Barbed Wire Dolls, and I Spit on Your Grave.
Come join the world of the hipsters, of the beatniks, the sicknicks. Now, a motion picture of pulse-pounding excitement.
Please bear with us. We must leave the rest of this sequence to your imagination.
Meet the girls of the Big Dollhouse.
They're young, they're beautiful, and they're killers.
Bill Landis has been writing exclusively about exploitation film for over 20 years.
They were very creepy, severe pictures.
Landis and his wife, Michelle Clifford, used to frequent the Deuce for cinematic thrills and lived to tell about it in their appropriately titled book, Sleazoid Express. Clifford remembers that the scope and variety of films screened in Times Square was astonishing.
Each theater had like a different vibe to it. Each theater had a different type of audience that went to it.
The Rialto featured gore films, the Liberty regularly scheduled Eurosleaze imports, and the Bijou specialized in kung fu triple features.
He's super cool, super quick, super deadly. Super Manchu. See it to believe your eyes.
The theaters themselves were also part of the exploitation experience. Back in the 70s and 80s, the Deuce was full of formerly grand movie palaces that in their dilapidated state had become known as grindhouses. These grindhouses were often scarier than the films they featured.
People would throw things. You would have to, you know, put a lighter down the seat to see if it was okay, if there was anything, you know, lurking in the seat, actually, before you sat down. The bathrooms were an experience in themselves.
Those brave enough to endure the surroundings were treated to frank and brutal films that major studios at the time would have never considered releasing. Again, Michelle Clifford.
Hollywood movies are kind of like what America's showing to the neighbors, but exploitation shows what people are thinking on their insides.
Scum of the earth, the real poor white trash. They live and die below Tobacco Road.
These movies are, at their best, are kind of emanations from the sort of collective unconsciousness. They tell us things that Hollywood movies often are afraid to.
David Edelstein reviews films for Slate and NPR's Fresh Air.
When you've been force-fed a diet of movies that have been machine-tooled by giant corporations that have been tested on audiences over and over, to sort of satisfy the lowest common denominator, to go to these movies that are abrasive and that are oftentimes very nihilistic is actually really exhilarating, because you're reminded what movies can do. You're reminded that, you know, movies aren't necessarily about telling beautiful stories beautifully. They can also be about telling really disgusting stories disgustingly.
Edelstein even suggests that the extreme and perverse elements found in exploitation film help develop a compelling visual language for mainstream directors brazen enough to use it.
Horror and exploitation has access to the sort of outlandish metaphor. You can use a zombie. You can take a vampire to express things about human desire and addiction. It's enormously liberating, and in fact takes you much further. If you look at the films of David Cronenberg, one of the great movies about terminal illness ever made is The Fly.
I'm saying I'm an insect who dreamt he was a man and loved it. But now the dream is over and the insect is awake.
As a thoughtful reminder that we are also discussing movies about axe murderers, zombies, and giant insects, Edelstein offers the following caveat.
I don't want to over-romanticize exploitation movies. 95% of them are just dreadful. They're crap.
By his own admission, exploitation filmmaker Herschel Gordon Lewis is firmly camped within the crap category. Save your Oscars for someone else.
There are those who make movies and would rather have someone say, what a brilliant piece of cinematography. Well, they're entitled to have that niche for themselves. My niche was, did you see that?
Which is exactly what people uttered back in 1963 when Lewis released his epic gore film, Blood Feast. The film was so grim and so gory that even the Blood Feast trailer required special warning.
The trailer, we called it The Coming Atrocity, showed somebody standing against a red background, and he said, ladies and gentlemen,
this picture
truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium.
Blood Feast not only enjoys the distinction of being the first in the gore film genre, it was also the first feature film to pass out barf bags to theater patrons.
Yes, I don't think I want that on my tombstone as an epitaph, but you're quite right. That was the first. We were the first in many ways.
Indeed, Lewis's gore gimmick would later show up in hit films like Halloween and Friday the 13th, all part of a pattern in which the tone and content of exploitation films was appropriated by major studios with bigger budgets and bigger returns. Back on 42nd Street, there is little evidence that Times Square had ever been the premier showcase for exploitation film. Nationwide, grindhouses and drive-in theaters have given way to the multiplexes that stick to mainstream fare. Film distribution today rarely gambles on a new release. They're looking for the next Harry Potter sequel and not the new installment of Fugitive Women. Banned from the big screens, gorehounds have been left to watch their sleaze in solitude on video and DVD. As David Edelstein notes, however, there is still plenty of the delightfully demented left to be discovered.
I have here from my collection an amazing film called Blood Freak. It's a movie made by sort of a church group with sort of religious intent to tell you about the evils of drug abuse, and it's about a giant turkey monster. It's exhilarating. You can't find this. Nobody would. How was this movie made? Who are these people?
In New York, for On the Media, I'm Rex Doan.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan, with Tony Field, our newest recruit, still fresh after a week on the job, which is a record for this show. The show was engineered by Dylan Keefe, George Edwards, and Irene Trudell, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball, Brian Tilley, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
He's super cool, super quick, super deadly.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bydale Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.